before tonight's talk, I was going to give a little bit more talk about the way that fear controls our lives and how we can overcome much of the things which we fear to find more freedom, more peace, more happiness, you know, in our lives. And one of the reasons for this is that someone sent me an email saying that for some people in the United States, some of these evangelical churches, they think the world is going to end on the 21st of May. That's tomorrow. So this is the last talk. But because they said this, this is one of the reasons why people sent me the email. There was this very sharp atheist entrepreneur who was saying, well, if you think the world is going to end and you think that all the believers are going to go up to heaven, like apparently in the religion they call it being enraptured, but it means your cats and dogs, because in that religion they don't have souls, that means they'll be left here on earth with no one to look after them. So I got this from the Washington Post. They said that you love your dogs and cats so much and soon you won't be there to feed them or to put water or milk in their bowl. So we can do that for you because we're atheists and we're not going anywhere at the end of the world. And so they were charging $350 a person, guaranteeing they would look after your pets after the end of the world. And they were making a killing, these people, because stupid people thought the end of the world was coming. So just the amount of stupidity people have is enormous. And so that's actually one of my favorite sayings, which I wrote down years ago. You may know that there was a philosopher, a French philosopher called Voltaire. And he once said that the only way to really understand and get your head around the mathematical concept of infinity is to start thinking about the extent of human stupidity. But nevertheless, why do people get involved in that? It's because sometimes that people use fear to control us, and sometimes fear controls you. And one of the nice things, which when I first came across Buddhism, that there was no such thing as that fear. In fact, the path made it very clear to try and overcome that fear. If ever you see a Buddha statue with a hand like this, it's not trying to stop the traffic. That particular Buddha statue is called the Abhaya Mudra, in other words, giving fearlessness, the open hand. In other words, being a gift to all beings, not to be afraid. And that's a beautiful thing which, you know, as a Buddhist monk who keeps precepts, it doesn't go around killing animals or hurting animals, that we actually give to, you know, the fellow creatures, you know, who we come in contact with. You know when you come in here, you're not going to be shouted at or you're not going to be hurt in any which way. And it means also the animals who live in Buddhist monasteries have a wonderful time because they too have fearlessness, which is why if you go to the nun's monastery or go to the monk's monastery, you can actually see there the animals, the kangaroos will come right up to you. Why? It's because over all those years they realize they're not afraid. It's such a beautiful thing, you know, to have animals who are not afraid of you. I remember just once over in Serpentine in the monastery, I was on a long retreat and this huge tiger snake came up and it was a huge one. I could measure it later on because it sort of was hiding from the sunshine. It was actually next to the brick wall. I know how long bricks were. And it was about 2.7 meters long. It was a very big snake. And when it came up to me, I was washing my bowl. And it came right up to me and it looked at me and I looked at the snake. And I said, hello, how are you going? And I carried on washing my bowl. And I wasn't even paying attention to it. And when I turned round again, it too had turned round. And its head was facing the opposite direction to me. And its tail was pointed to me, only a couple of feet away. I could have done any damage to it. But I think it would do that simply because, It had an idea of fearlessness. There was no way we were going to harm any creature like a snake. Of course, my favorite snake story, and I've told this before, but it's such a great story, I can't resist telling it again, was when I was meditating all night in Thailand. Now, in Thailand, these snakes are really dangerous. I mean, you know, they, even the ones in Australia are more dangerous, but in Thailand, they do bite people. And you know, sometimes you die. So anyway, I'd been meditating all night, so no sleep. And of course, in the morning, one of the first things you do is to urinate. So I got up and I went into the forest, into the bush to urinate. And you know, you don't sort of stand up, you know, to do your business in the Asian tradition. You squat down. So there I was squatting down and urinating in the forest. The first light of day, you know, I was a bit sort of tired, so I wasn't that mindful. And when I started urinating, I really did think I was urinating on a stick. But then the stick started to move. And I realized, oh, I'm peeing on a snake. Now that was a very, very dangerous thing to do. I would not try that on a snake in Australia. But maybe the snakes in Thailand, they know a monk. And they realize a monk is not going to harm them. Even as I often say when I tell this story, and the women won't really get this, but the men really, they feel this. The most sensitive part of a male's body was only about 6 inches from the mouth of that snake. That was very, very dangerous. But the snake never bit me. He just carried on sort of having a nice morning, and I wondered why that was. And afterwards, of course, you realize it's not just the monks, you know, were nothing that snakes could be afraid of, because they got used to us, we got used to them. It was also because I'm pretty sure the snake, being a Thai snake, probably being a Buddhist, realized it was being blessed but with holy water. And you can't get more holy than straight from the bladder of a monk. Maybe it's also because it was nice and warm, having a nice bath. But anyway, that was the day I peed on a snake and got away with it. It's because we're fearless. And it's because the animals don't fear us, because people don't fear you. That is why we have this beautiful relationship. When you can come close, you can ask questions, and you realize that you're not going to be harmed either physically or emotionally. And what a beautiful thing that is. So by giving that fearlessness to other people, it's not just fearless to animals, giving that fear to you as well. So you're not afraid of what's going to happen to you in here. And when I was thinking about this talk a few minutes ago, I'm thinking I'm going to talk about like 3 types of fear. First of all is that the fear of like physical discomfort, you know, which is probably a good fear. Then there's a fear of people criticizing you and putting you down. And lastly, there's the fear I really wanted to focus on today. You know, the fear of like losing things which we're really attached to, the fear of freedom and peace and happiness. Now that's a very interesting one. But I'll go through the other ones first of all. The fear of like physical discomfort, you know, pain, sickness and death and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes the way that as a monk I've dealt with that is think, well, you're going to get sick, you're going to die anyway. So, you know, if you do sort of do something wrong and something happens to you and you die early, well, you know, think of it this way. You know, you're probably a good people. You're going to go to heaven anyway. Let's get there quicker. Let's fast track instead of waiting around. And after all, when you really think of it, if you live a long life, well, what happens to you when you live a long life? You know, go to these old people's homes and, you know, you have to start wearing nappies again. And it's all back to, you know, just as you started. It's quite uncomfortable. It reminds me of that story of the 2 old men sitting down and talking to one another. And they were in their sort of 70s or 80s. And one said to the other, oh, just it's so terrible being old. You know, I just ache all over the place. And just, you know, I can't do things like I used to do. Life is so difficult being old. And the other friend, who was just about the same age, said, what do you mean? So it's wonderful. I feel like a newborn baby. I said, how is that? He said, well, look at me. I've got no hair, no teeth, and I've just wet my pants again. Because that's what it's like when you get old. You keep doing the same old things again and again and again. But as a Buddhist, you know, you start to feel that what am I afraid of? No matter what happens, I can deal with it. Because in my life, many of the things which I was afraid of, even like physical pain, physical discomfort, you know, realized it was not really a rational fear. Now, each one of you have, you know, gone through pain and sickness, you've gone through death, you handled it. You can do it. And sometimes it may be painful, it may be difficult, it may be sort of tough, but in the end, maybe because I've lived so long now, that you really realize that, you know, it's actually worth it. You actually learn so much from the difficulties and the disappointments of life. And to me now, I realize that's where you start doing your growth. I call it growing pain. So all the times when, you know, I have a relationship which doesn't work, or a divorce, or a child who starts to misbehave, or a death in the family, or, you know, something goes wrong in your life, whatever it is. Yeah, it does feel very difficult and painful at the time, but, you know, after it's happened, you look back and you think, my goodness, I grew and I learned so much from that. It is growing pains. Which is why I had to say to someone recently, and I said to this because they were really suffering from a very bad cancer. And I said, look, a lot of people have had those cancers, and a lot of people have got through them. It was very unpleasant at the time. But I don't know how many people, because I've dealt with these people, lots of them, I don't know how many people, I can't count them, have come up to me and said that cancer was the best thing which ever happened to them. And of course I hear that first of all, the first time, and I think, you know, that person's crazy. When you hear it just now, 20, 30, 100 times, you think there's something going on there. I've never had cancer, but there's other sicknesses which I've had. And why is it they come along and say this, you know, it's the best thing which ever happened to me? Because they learned so much from that sort of disease, that trauma in their life. And this is what I mean. Whatever happened to you in your life, and if you've lost, you know, just somebody just came, was actually calling me just about the death in the family, and they said that's the time when they can really reflect on things. You know, that's when they sort of stand back in the business of their life. Someone very close to them has died, and they start to really think about what really is happening in life, and what is this purpose of life, and what we should really be doing. And this is what happens. It's why these things, yes, they're a bit painful, they're disappointing, but we grow so much from them. And when you keep that in mind, it should make it very clear that why be afraid of these experiences? Yes, they may have a painful part to them, but if you look to the other part of them, which sometimes we don't look at, it means that, you know, we sort of miss things. Now this, sometimes when I talk like this, people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm is just, you know, talking about sort of, you know, positive psychology. This is modern. It's not real part of the old Buddhism, which was taught by the Buddha. But there was one sutra, this is the ancient teachings of the Buddha, which I remember very, very well, because just before I came to Australia 27 years ago, when I gave a talk to the monks in Thailand, just the last talk before I boarded the plane to come here, this was actually the teaching which I gave them. It was straight from the sutra, because it was very similar. There was a monk who went up to the Buddha in that old time, and he said, I want to go to this country a long way away, you know, to spread the Dharma, to build up some Buddhism and to help people in this faraway country, just like I was coming to Australia. And the Buddha said to this monk, oh, that particular country, you know, it's very rough. People are very coarse and very violent in that country. And I'm not saying Australia is like that, but people laughed when I made that comparison in Thailand. And the Buddha said, what would happen, you know, if you went to that country and people talk badly about you, and they cursed you? And he thought, well, you know, at least they would feed me. And then the Buddha said, what if they don't feed you? He said, well, at least they don't hit me. But what if they hit you? Well, it's only a fist. It's not as if they stab me with daggers. What if they stab you with daggers and swords? Well, at least they don't kill me. But what if they kill you? Well, it just means I go to heaven quicker. And the Buddha said, now that's a real monk, you can go. And of course he went there, and people didn't do those things, just like they did those things here in Australia. They're really kind people. But that positive psychology, straight from the word of the Buddha in the time of the Buddha, what would happen if, you know, you got sick? Oh, well, you know, at least I wouldn't die. What happens if you die? Well, you made so much good karma, you go to heaven or you get enlightened, so what's the big problem? Have you ever noticed that fear is always associated with negativity? We're afraid of something, and what we're actually afraid of, we see all the negative consequences of what might happen to us. And it's that negativity which we add to the future, which is called fear. It's not what might happen. It's not the full picture. But it's what might happen which might be bad. And the other part of things we just refuse to see. It is a negativity towards the future. And of course, yeah, the future may be painful. It's also very pleasant as well. We don't know what's going to happen next. It's going to be disappointing, but also a lot of fun as well. That's your life. It has been like that so far. It will be like that in the future. Yeah, you'll have your tears, but a lot of laughs as well. So why be so afraid? If you have the bigger picture, if you have wisdom, then the fear does not control you. And actually you may be able to use it to help you, as in the story which I told last Tuesday night in the Armadale group, and they thought it was very funny that once upon a time there was a dog who went for a walk in the forests in Africa. And he walked a bit too far because a lion saw him. And the lion thought, that dog will make a good dinner. And the dog heard that. How could a dog escape from a lion? But this dog, he must have listened to some of the YouTube talks from here, because he was a very, very smart dog. I'm sure he was a Buddhist. So what he did, he managed to find some bones, and he sat in front of the bones with his back towards the lion, totally unafraid. And as the lion was about to pounce, the dog licked his lips and said, what a delicious meal. These lions are very, very tasty. I wonder when I can get my next lion to eat. And the lion heard that and thought, my goodness, that must be a really vicious dog. He's eaten another lion. I'm not going to be his dinner. And so the lion turned around and ran away. But there was a monkey, and that monkey saw that conversation, and he said, I'm not going to let the dog get away with tricking this lion. So he went up to the lion and said, you've been tricked. You're a fool. You know, this dog, you know, can't eat lions. You know, he just said this to scare you away. And so the lion got very upset and said, I'm going to go and eat that dog. And the monkey said, can I come with you to watch? So the monkey jumped on the lion's back, and the lion went straight towards the dog, and the dog saw them coming. So he went in front of the pile of bones again, with his back towards the lion and the monkey on the back. And as they came close, the dog licked his lips again. And he said, where's that damn monkey? He promised he'd bring me another lion. And that was the way the wise dog who came to Nolamara Center, or at least listened to the iPod talks on YouTube, could escape. Because people are just so superstitious, and they're just so afraid sometimes. You wonder just why people actually are afraid. What are you afraid of? So a lot of times it's physical discomfort. Number one, physical discomfort. You can always overcome physical discomfort. You can always deal with it. You're tough enough. You can learn from it. You can grow from it. And actually, it is growing pain, which is why, as a Buddhist, you're not afraid of these things. If they happen, rather than didn't happen, but you know you can deal with them. You can deal with anything. But even worse than that, for many people, is the fear of criticism, is the fear of being put down, is the fear of being diminished in the eyes of your peers, on the eyes of others. And that is a fear which stops people talking to one another, making relationships. It's a sort of fear which people say stops people going in front of a microphone and giving a talk. As for me, when I first gave a talk, I overcome that fear of what other people think of me by realizing whichever way it went, it would always be a win-win situation for me. I thought if people didn't like my talks and they all walked out, that would be wonderful because I could now be a hermit, and that's what monks are really supposed to do. And if they like my talks, that's wonderful too, because then I can share with everybody. So for me, just it didn't really matter. If you like the talks, great. If you don't like the talks, that's even better. So actually, I gave a talk on radio the other night. It was on Philip Adams, Tuesday Night Live or something. Anyway, late night life, yeah, very late. But fortunately, it was late in Sydney or Melbourne, wherever he was, but not so late in Perth. And it was actually one of the other monks, Ajahn Bhumali, got me into that. And I don't really like doing those things late at night, but I thought, it doesn't matter. You know, if it works, that's good. If it doesn't work, he won't bother me anymore. So I had a nice time, and so pretty relaxed. And one of the questions was asked, you know, if you didn't hear it, you know, is Buddhism a religion? Because many people say Buddhism is a philosophy, not a religion. So what I replied to him, I said, well, Buddhism is a religion for tax purposes. Because, you know, we have to pay the bills, and it's nice to get a bit of tax relief. So because you're really relaxed and you're having a bit of fun, that's sometimes when you come across very well. When you haven't got any fear, you come across as confident. And in that confidence, you usually perform well. You can crack jokes and have a bit of humor in life. And that's one of the reasons why I crack jokes. I don't care if you don't like the joke. I don't care because I like the joke and I laugh. And that's good enough for me. So understanding that just not worrying what other people think of you is a way that, you know, you can actually do what you think is the right thing to do, say what you think is the right thing to do, and have this beautiful sense of freedom rather than always spending your whole life trying to please others. And you know, that's, I looked at my life a long time ago and I thought, is that really a way to live a life? Always worrying what other people think of you and how they judge you and what they say about you. And of course, you know, when I first came to the West as a Buddhist monk, you know, with a bald head and with these robes on, I mean, that was really good fun because you really look weird. And because you look weird, sometimes, this one event which I will never forget, and I can picture it now. When we first came to Perth, we lived in actually a house in North Perth, in Magnolia Street. Many of you may remember that house in Magnolia Street. And we were working really hard. I was the main builder of our monastery. And so we'd come up on a Friday evening. Ajahn Jagra would give the talk. I would spend most of the weekend sleeping because I was really so tired. And on Sunday afternoon, we'd actually load up the vehicle, you know, which was an older VW, and it's amazing how much stuff we would get in that vehicle. I remember picking up a whole heap of wood once from the timber yard, and it was packed, you know, inside a VW. Inside, you couldn't move all the timber, and we put it on the top, on the roof rack as well. And the guy who packed it in there said, you Buddhist monks must be really good at praying. How that car can move, we don't know. You must have somebody on your side. But that particular day, I was packing that car with stuff, and this young girl came out, and she was about like 12 or 13 years of age. She was visiting her auntie or something next door, and she came and looked at me in my robe, and she came right up. She put her hands on her hip, and she looked up and down at me with utter disgust, which is only about a 12 or 13-year-old can do. And she looked up at me and said, you're dressed like a girl. That's sick. Yuck. And that made me laugh so much. I thought, what a wonderful thing that was. Because she was really trying to embarrass me. She was trying to upset me. And I thought it was terribly funny. So she was very disappointed with my reaction. But, you know, it was true what she said. I was dressed like a girl. But I'm a monk, not a girl. So, you know, just because you wear these robes. But anyway, so you're not really afraid what other people think of you. And you know, sometimes, like, you know, being dressed like this, you create a lot of happiness. look at your clothes here. It's all greys here this evening. At least I've got something bright on, something uplifting and something positive. And especially whenever I go to England, because people always grey overcoats and always black this and grey that. No one wears any colour in that country. So I remember going to one of those cities in the black country. They used to do that because it was this industrial heart, you know, the Midlands of UK, in a place. Are you really cold over there? Ah, come on, have a warm heart. Well, that's Buddhist air conditioning. Buddhist climate control. When it's hot, keep a cool head. When it's cold, keep a warm heart. That's called Buddhist air conditioning. But anyhow, back to the Midlands. When I went there to visit some relations, and I went on a walk early in the morning with my cousin, you know, what exercise. So we went on a walk, and all the people we passed, they were pointing at me and laughing. Look at him. Look at that guy. And I'd never got such, you know, sort of a reaction in other cities in that country. But I was quite happy because I was making people laugh. And then I actually found out why they were laughing at me. We passed this big poster for a circus. The circus was in town, and they really thought I was one of the clowns. Well, I didn't mind that. I thought it was really good fun. So, as a monk, you know, why do you worry what people think of you? They don't know who you are. So why are you worried about what other people think or say about you? Isn't it a wonderful state of freedom not to be afraid what other people think of you or say about you, and instead to have this beautiful freedom from fear, just to be who you are and who you want to be and who you need to be, rather than always trying to please other people and try to avoid them criticizing you, because they don't criticize you anyway. They say bad things about you anyway. So why bother trying to stop them? They're going to do it anyway. So if you're going to call me an idiot, a fool, I might as well actually enjoy it and, you know, be idiotic and be foolish. It's really good fun being an idiot, being a fool sometimes. You feel so free, you can do whatever you want. And do you know the eccentrics and English people are in the Guinness Book of Records, they're the most eccentric people in the whole world. And I never forget reading a story of this eccentric who lived again in this Midlands of England. And he lived on his roof. I mean, he really did live on his roof. He ate up there, he slept up there, not just in the summertime, in the wintertime too. When it rained, he was up on his roof. It snowed, he was up on his roof. And he was really healthy. Because all these eccentrics, you know, they always are very, very healthy people. And, you know, it's a medical fact. And one of the things is, because they're not worried what other people think of you. People are worried what, you know, what other people think of you. You're so tense and you're so fearful. That kills you at a young age. So my advice for you is go back tonight, get a ladder and go and sleep on your roof. Maybe not do that, but... Please don't do that, because, you know, otherwise this Buddhist Society of West Australia will be sued tonight. Ajahn Brahm said I should do this. So please do not do that. But you can understand this, what I'm actually saying. Just be yourself, which means that you cannot be so afraid what other people think of you. You become fearless. And anyway, one of the ancient pieces of wisdom, which I got a long time ago, was about how when you're in your 20s, when you're a young person, that's when you really are very concerned what other people think of you. That's why young girls have to dress fashionably. That's why guys, they also have to be fashionable with their hair and with their speech. They have to have street cred or disco cred or nightclub cred. And you know, you see your kids like that. They're very, very concerned what their peers think of them. And, you know, you've been through that, and just, you know, looking in your mirror, making sure that, you know, that you're not going to get criticized by your friends because of the way you've got your hair or your clothes. Let's say when you're young, you're really concerned what other people think of you. But usually when you get into your 40s or 50s, you know, you get what's called self-confidence. So you don't care how you dress or what your hair is like that much. You know, you're going to do it anyway. In other words, you couldn't give a damn what other people think of you. You've got self-confidence. And then finally, in your 60s, it's taken you all that time. In your 20s, you're really concerned what other people think of you. In your 40s, you don't care what other people are thinking of you. In your 60s, you'll finally discover that people weren't thinking about you anyway. And if you could only discover that now, they're not thinking about you. Do what you want to do. Say what you want to say, because they're not thinking about you. They're usually thinking about themselves or somebody else. So that way you can be totally free of what other people think of me. And isn't that so much relaxing, so much of a burden? Like you're free from jail. But even deeper than that, go to that fear, or that beyond fear, so that you're totally free to be happy, to be peaceful. Because I found that there's a lot of times that people, when they live a monastic life or they start a spiritual life, you can go so far, but you're afraid of going further. I notice many people in our society are actually afraid to be happy. And it's something which has been deeply brainwashed into us, that it's wrong to be happy. Maybe you may think that so many people are suffering, so many people are hurting, so many people are poor, so many people are hungry. Why should I be happy? I'll tell you one reason why. Because it's one less person that people like me have to worry about. And the people who are hungry, the people who are in pain, they like to see someone who's happy. It lifts them up as well. So don't use as an excuse the fact that other people are suffering as a reason why you shouldn't be happy. If everybody felt like that, no one would ever be happy. So you break the mold. You be happy. Another reason, and this is a deeper reason, is a lot of people think they don't deserve to be happy. And that is one of the obstacles which I have come across as a teacher, that you get people so far and they're free of many of their difficulties and problems, and then they go and create more problems for themselves. What are you doing that for? And you talk to them, you get to know them, and you realize that they are actually afraid of being happy. There's a sense that they are used to who they are, the pain, the difficulty. They are literally attached to suffering. Fascinating thing to know, but many of you are attached to suffering. There's one story, one anecdote, you know, from the early years of my spiritual search. In the days of the hippies, there was this really weird guy called Ram Dass. If anyone has been in this business as long as me, Baba Ram Dass. He was actually a psychologist from Harvard University who dropped out, started experimenting with drugs, went to India and came back and started, you know, as a guru, you know, as one of these Western Indian gurus with long hair and beads, the whole works. He really looked weird. You know, much more weird than me. You know, it's actually Ajahn Brahm, but with long hair. And he wrote some interesting things. And one of the anecdotes was he had one of his disciples, this young girl, now maybe 20s or 30s, and her father was really sick in hospital with one of these terrible diseases. And, you know, she invited her guru, this Ram Dass, to come and visit her father, maybe he could do something, because he was in constant pain. And the doctors, you know, in this medical facility weren't able to get the right drug to, you know, to relieve him from his agony. So she went in with this guru, and as soon as this, you know, redneck American saw this crazy guy with long hair and beads and these hippie robes, He said, get away. I don't want to talk to you. So he was just standing in the corner while the man's daughter was just talking with him and just holding his hand. And this Ram Dass guy thought, well, I'm not doing anything. Maybe I'll give this guy a foot massage. And so he started giving him reflexology. And it felt nice. So the guy let him do this. And after 2 or 3 minutes, all his pain disappeared. And when he realized for the first time in many days he was pain free, he told that guru, get off my feet, leave them alone. Because he'd rather have the pain than have the pain relieved and be totally confused by something he didn't understand. He was afraid of having his worldview challenged. There are many ways that fear stops us from being happy, stops us being free of pain. I remember, I think I was with Dennis once. We went to a grief and loss conference, and I will never forget when I gave a talk on how to escape from grief, especially the grief of a family member who's tragically died, and being bailed up afterwards by an elderly lady who was so angry at me. And she was angry at me for trying to take away her grief. And at that I realized that that lady was attached to her pain. She was afraid to let go of the pain, even though it would be freeing for her. She'd rather have the pain. I've seen so often people are attached to even negative things. Because really all fear is knowing that something which you're attached to is being taken away from you. And it's the attachment is the cause of that fear. This is my pain. This is my grief. And I don't want you to take it away. Which is why when the Buddha started talking about attachments, he got very deep into the psychology of the mind and realized that was the cause of fear. The more attachments you have, the more likely you are to be afraid. If you're attached to the possessions in your house, you're afraid of burglars. If you realize, well, these things don't really belong to me anyway, I just use them for a time. Burglar comes, burglar doesn't come. Well, you know, it's only things. If you're attached to your relationships, you think these are the most important part of your life, and you can't exist without my partner. What will I do without you, darling? You know you'll do pretty well after you get over the separation, as people usually do. I've seen that many, many times. You know, you survive. But when we think that, you know, we're so attached, that's where the fear comes from. And look, now, going back to relationships, when you think like that, when you think that I can't live without you, then that fear, now, coming from the attachment, gives rise to controlling. I'm saying this is fear. Where it comes from is attachment. But what it leads to is this terrible controlling. And sometimes people are so afraid of losing their partner, they control their partner so much. The relationship is so like being in a prison. It's so uncomfortable. It's so painful. The relationship finishes. And that's tragic. The thing you were afraid of, you bring about because of your controlling nature. Have you ever noticed that that's where all control comes from fear? That's why, you know, governments use fear. That's why those religions use fear. The world is going to end tomorrow. So, you know, that controls you. You know, there's too many migrants coming into Australia on the boats. It's controlling you. All fear, you know, is a means of control. So really be afraid, be concerned about that. And all the fear of something's going to go wrong in my life means you try and control your body, you control your life, you don't let go, you don't get tense. So you get too tense, you don't learn how to relax, which is why it usually things do go wrong. Now, how many people are being afraid of getting cancer, getting all these other terrible diseases which are out there? People who are really afraid of this are usually the people who get it. I went to many, many malaria areas in Thailand. Other people got malaria, not me. Because I think I wasn't afraid of it. Because I wasn't afraid of these things. I didn't tense up. because I didn't tense up and get stressed and worry so much, you know, my immune system was much stronger. Why is it that some people get diseases and some people don't? Fear is one of the most important parts of why people get diseases. Fear, control, tension, stress, immune deficiency. Be careful of fear. But anyway, if the fear comes from their attachments, you wonder, what am I attached to? I'm not attached to my reputation. That's why I can talk about anything at any time. And just, if I'm making mistakes, say something stupid, you know, who cares? I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not attached to my reputation. I'm not attached to my things. So if I lose something, that's okay. I don't own it anyway. If I get sick and die, I don't own my body. I can let it go. But in particular, sort of, when I'm not attached to any pain or suffering, I allow myself to be happy. I'm not afraid of happiness. Are you afraid to be happy? Why is it you can't enjoy happiness when it's given to you? Why is it that sometimes you're at home having a wonderful day and you think, something must be wrong, I'm happy? There was a nun who visited Perth many, many years ago. She was Australian, but no, she was ordained over in UK. And again, this was one of those experiences which made me very sad. She was getting into a very, very deep state of meditation, almost into these amazing jhanas, incredible bliss and power. She was right on the edge. And I was, you know, teaching her, encouraging her, you know, showing what to overcome next. But she got so close, but she couldn't go any further. And I was at my wit's end, trying to think, what's going wrong? Why can't you go further? Why can't you go all the way? And then she told me, she said, I don't think I deserve so much happiness. And when I heard that, it was just, to me, it was like a dagger inside. I think, oh, come on, you do deserve such happiness. Who told you you can't deserve such happiness? Why can't you be free? Who said that? But a lot of times it's, again, our conditioning. You know, when we're very young, you know, we think, no, you don't deserve to be happy. You've got to work for it. Or you've got to do something for it. Or you've got to pray to a God and maybe you're happy when you die. Or maybe, you know, you've got to sort of get enlightenment and then you can be happy. So much stuff in our lives is saying, no, you can't be happy now. But that's something which I rejected. And something when I saw Buddhism, I realized that is actually wrong. You don't need anything to be happy. There's no entry fee to happiness. And everybody in this room qualifies. So you're not rejected, you're not shut out. It's not like some sort of elite club where you have to be elected as a member to be rich or to have connections, you know, in order to join. The Happiness Club is free and open to everybody. So please come in, enjoy it. But you know, one of the reasons we're afraid, because you know, when you're really, really happy, have you ever noticed it's when you really let go and you lose control? That's one of the things with happiness. You can't control it anymore. You just have to disappear into that happiness. Because much of the time when you start to control things, you usually make it much worse. When you let go, then happiness comes. This is why we meditate, so you can experience this for yourselves. When you try to meditate, it never works. When you let go, then it does work. I was just talking to some of the monks a couple of days ago. It was actually to Ajahn Bamali when I picked him up. He's just come back from Singapore on Thursday. That's actually yesterday. There's one of these star meditators who lives in Kuala Lumpur. She was on one of the meditation retreats which I was giving over in Thailand, and she was just like everybody else, was getting nowhere, trying to meditate, maybe getting into the breath, maybe getting quiet, and then sort of nothing happening, and just after 8 or 9 days, just really so frustrated as some people are. And then we had the end of the retreat. We finished, gave all the blessings, the metta meditation, finished off. And lunch was in about 45 minutes or an hour. And after the lunch, you know, the buses were to take you back to the airport. No, people were supposed to go and use that time to clean up their rooms. But she had another bus or another flight, so she wasn't leaving till the late afternoon. So she told me she had an hour to kill. Nothing to do. So she thought, I might as well meditate. To kill time. And that's when she wasn't expecting anything. She didn't try and control her mind. She didn't do anything, just them doing nothing. Brilliant. That's when she got a beautiful meditation. And I love it when people have their first really deep meditation, because they come up to me, and the nearest thing I can describe it is when, like, a young girl, a young boy falls in love. You know, when they've just all got sort of sparkles in their eyes and the whole world is beautiful. Oh, Jabram, it's so nice, it's so wonderful. Oh, life is so good and so happy. Because that's what happens when you get deep meditation. You get enormous happiness. And she did that because she never expected it. She stopped controlling and she got all this happiness. And sometimes people are afraid of that happiness. Please don't be afraid. Yes, you're out of control. You can't control it. Let it be. Why control it? You're having a great time. You have to get out of the way. It's you. You are the problem. The attachment to you, the controller, the one who owns things, the one who does things in the whole life, that's what has to disappear in order to really bliss out. So why are we afraid? I mention this because, again, even in the time of the Buddha would actually point out that in the spiritual path, you'll come across many barriers of fear. Fear whether you deserve to go further. Fear of the enormous happiness and power of going further. But that fear, please let it be. Overcome it. You deserve happiness. You can do it. And the bliss, which is, you know, beyond your control, is worth it. Just as a personal anecdote, just remember just once being really so close to very deep states of meditation, and it was like you were standing on the edge of a cliff. You didn't really want to jump, because, ooh, can I handle this? A lot of fear. A lot of fear because you're really going to lose your sense of self and lose control. But then it looked so nice in there. It was so joyful and so wonderful. But no, it's just too fearful. But it was so beautiful. But no, I can't do it. But it's so nice. And eventually I'm going for it. Those of you who are adventurous, those of you who've got courage, you're the ones who make great strides in the spiritual life. The courage to let go. The courage to allow happiness to come in your life. The courage to be free. Often say that your life is like being lived in a prison cell. You are in prison, but you should realize by now your cell door is open. You can walk out any time. But just like real prisoners, sometimes they don't want to be free. They're afraid of the world beyond their cell door. They're afraid of new things, strange things. They're afraid of even happiness. I think you know what I'm talking about. It may be the cell of your past, the guilt which you may have of something you've done. It may be just, you know, just your, as they say, your comfort zone. But be adventurous. Be free. Be peaceful. Allow happiness to come. And don't be afraid of it. Don't think that there's something wrong somewhere. I know in this one of the most extreme of the Christian paths was Puritanism. Somebody once sent me a definition of Puritanism, and that was the fear. It was a fear thing. It was a fear that somewhere, someone is being happy. And always thinking that no pain, no gain, they kept on saying. And that is wrong. No happiness, no gain. That is a path of Buddhism. No happiness, no gain. So this should be a happy path. Don't be afraid of that happiness. Because the more you come to places like this, the more you develop your meditation, the more you develop your insight, it's going to get happier and happier and happier. That's what we mean, letting go of problems, letting go of suffering, being free. So don't be afraid to be free. You're like little birds coming out of the little chicks, coming out of the eggs, cracking into the sunlight. It must be very scary for those little chicks to come out of the egg. It must be even more frightening to fly for the first time. But once you start flying, Mum and Dad can't stop you anymore. Little baby birds are off, having a time of their lives. That's what spiritual life is about. Being free. Flying off. Even though you're leaving your little egg, you're leaving your parents, you're leaving all that you've known. But the call of freedom, of happiness, is so great. Really, you won't be able to resist it. So don't be afraid of freedom. Don't be afraid of happiness. When those barriers come, take the path of happiness. Take the path of freedom. Take the path of peace. It's worth it. You don't have to do so much in your life. I only do so much because I always say yes to invitations. Yes, when people invite me. Be free. Do nothing. Be happy. And see what happens. I've lost my clock, and the clock at the back has stopped, so that must be about right. Yeah, it is. Not bad. 5-2. It's upside down. So, that's the talk this evening about fear and overcoming fear, especially overcoming the fear of freedom and happiness. Thank you for listening. So, any questions? And please, do not be afraid to ask the question. Any questions tonight? There is. Yeah. Aha, yes. You weren't paying attention. That's very good. Well done. So it's obviously very peaceful. You in deep meditation? Contemplating emptiness? Yeah, something like that, yeah. Okay, got a friend, he had a sort of, is it tumor you said? What happened? But he's actually lost, he's losing his eyesight. Okay. Yeah, summing up with the brain. I've known many, many people who've had disabilities, and great disabilities, small disabilities. The usual case is that they get to realize that life is not diminished. There is something much more important than even seeing or hearing. What's this case? There was a case of... I wrote about this in one of my books. There was a case which I read in a scientific journal. There was a boy who was born deaf. And one day his parents took him for a medical checkup with his GP. His GP had just read an article, you know, in one of the medical magazines, that some researchers had found that 10% of children who were born deaf could have their hearing restored. And with a very simple operation, but only 10%. So the doctor said, it seems that your boy, you know, might be one of those 10%. Would you like to give it a try? And you know, the parents asked, you know, is it really invasive? Is it going to be painful? It's going to be a bit of discomfort, but you know, who knows? You know, your kid may hear as a result of the operation. So the parents gave the child the operation, and it worked. The child could hear again. And as soon as the child recovered from the operation, with his hearing restored, he was really angry and upset at his parents. He said, why did you not ask me if I wanted to hear? He said, this is a terrible, terrible noise. I've got to figure this one out now. He said, if you really wanted to help me, give me another hand. Because he had learned to use his hands to explore the world where other people would have used sound. And when I realized that this was a person who there was deaf. He was a person who understood what it was like. And he said that's actually much better. He preferred being deaf than having all of that mind space, that brain space, used for other parts of his senses to explore the world. And you find that people who are missing one sense or deficient in one sense, the mind compensates and the other senses are really, really acute. There's something happening there. Yeah, the sense of sight may be diminished, but the mind is never diminished. Really, the mind does not need to be disabled just because one sense of sight is lost. And people who have survived great traumas, paraplegics, it is the strength of their mind which gives them this enormous quality of life. Stay like Stephen Hawking, this incredible sort of mathematician, philosopher. You know, I think he was 20 when he was, or 21, 22, when he was diagnosed with motor neurone disease. And whenever he gets on TV, the only way he can talk is through a synthesizer. But it's just a powerful, strong mind. And it's not just his ability in sort of physics and mathematics, which was astounding. But it's also his quality of life. He's a happy person. Even just wheelchair bound, hardly able to talk. Disability is a physical thing. You should never allow to make the mind diminished. It's the saying of the Buddha, even though the body is sick, you don't need to make the mind sick with it. However, many people do that. They identify with the body so much, they attach to the body so much, that when part of the body goes, they think that's the end. It's not the end. The mind is paramount. So other parts of his sensory faculties will be enhanced. When he can't see, he can hear much more deeply and he could feel much more. And people who have done that, they say, just, look, I can feel just what you will never be able to feel, Ajahn Brahm. And I can hear such things which are beyond you. Am I disabled? They say, Ajahn Brahm, you're disabled. Understand? I don't know, maybe you can actually suggest that to your friend. Sorry? They're going to like that. Well, if he doesn't like it, then maybe don't tell it to him. At least not all in one go. But just, you know, as he loses his sight, just, you can actually maybe encourage him just to say, well, you know, that there is other parts of you which are going to grow instead. There's other parts which are going to compensate. Discover what those parts are. So in other words, give him something to do, something to investigate, some place to go. Okay, well, that's the best I can give you on a Friday night in 5 minutes.